Welcome to the Book Show. Physician and acclaimed novelist Daniel Mason has a gift for finding the extraordinary in everyday life. His new novel, Country People, follows a young family who's moved to rural Vermont, becomes an unexpected journey into folklore, community, and imagination. Daniel Mason is next on this week's Book Show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Daniel Mason has long been one of fiction's most inventive voices. The physician and Stanford psychiatrist first captivated readers with The Piano Tuner, and his acclaimed novels include The Winter Soldier and best-selling North Woods. His latest, Country People, begins with a family pulling up stakes for a fresh start in Vermont. Miles imagines the move will finally give him time to finish his long overdue dissertation on Russian folklore and Russian folk tales. Instead, he discovers an unforgettable cast of neighbors, strange local traditions, and whispers of a hidden world beneath the Vermont hills. What unfolds is at once comic, it is lyrical, it is quietly profound, it is a novel about reinvention, imagination, family life, and the enduring power of myth. Please join me live from South Hadley, Massachusetts, Daniel Mason. Welcome. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
It's really a great pleasure to have you here. I've been a big fan of your work, and I was pleased. Would you consider, maybe I'm off base, but I really came to know you through North Woods. Was that typical?
I think so. I mean, my mom has been reading me for a longer period.
Sure, yeah.
But I think North Woods changed somewhat, I think, my encounters with readers.
What was it? Was there anything different about that novel?
It's tough to say, I guess. So for me, if I think back at my writing, there was this book that I wrote called The Winter Soldier.
Yeah.
And my life is sort of like a before Winter Soldier and after Winter Soldier, because Winter Soldier took me 14 years to write. And was a very difficult experience, and I thought of throwing it away many times. And I think that, you know, after that, and it was historical fiction, sort of deep historical fiction. After that, I ended up having, you know, perhaps because of the, you know, we could say almost traumatic experience of doing that, a different attitude towards my writing. And so, sort of since then, but with a short story collection and Northwoods and Country People, I've looked at differently, I guess. So in that sense, you know, I think Northwoods maybe was the beginning of this sort of different time for me.
So what brought you to the idea behind Country People and really Miles and his family?
This definitely began with Northwoods, and you're gonna, having heard the description of the story, you're gonna sort of recognize some autobiographical threads. I was originally going to write, I think, a book about California, but then during the pandemic, my family had come out to New England. I just fell in love. It was during the fall. I was wandering around, seeing these old cellar holes, these old walls, and became very interested in the history. And so then changed plans, decided to write about the area, came out for a full year. I should say that I hope I'm not stepping on any local rivalries, but I had a very lovely visit to Hadley at the Farm Museum. And actually, if you look at my phone, there's sort of like beautiful New England, beautiful New England, beautiful New England, like farm tools, farm tools, farm tools, farm tools, farm tools. And so a lot of actually much of the stage props, much of the props in Northwoods come from the Farm Museum in Hadley. And so I finished that book, but I kept on thinking about New England, and many of the characters from that book sort of refused to go away. And then also thought about this experience that my family had as a group of city people from the Bay Area, having picked up with all sorts of notions about what a year in rural New England might be like, and began to write those down. And not surprisingly, it sort of lent itself immediately to a comedy. And it took some time for me to accept that I might be doing this. I was afraid of doing that. But at a certain point, that was all I was writing, and I just decided to go along with it.
What were you afraid of?
I was afraid of telling a joke and not having anyone laugh.
Oh, well, welcome to the club.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's sort of this amazing thing where, telling any kind of, we all know, we're all terrified of something like that happening. And, you know, I would be in my room writing by myself and I might think it was funny and then I would repeat it. And then, you know, some jokes wouldn't be funny, but some jokes would be a little bit, remain funny. You know, eventually I'd run it by my family, but they also share my sort of idiosyncratic sense of humor. And so the idea that, like, you know, I'll put this out there and people may not get it, that I think kept me back. And Northwoods has humor in it, but it's like embedded in other stuff.
What were you afraid they wouldn't get in the sense of, because of the characters, of their idiosyncrasies, and this family moving in and having to try to figure that out?
Yeah, I think that, so the father Miles is central in the book.
Yes.
And he's this particular person. He, like it's been mentioned, is I think 12 years late on his dissertation. I think at times utterly frustrating to his wife, but at the same time has this wonderful ability to just like be interested in anyone, anywhere, and he wants to hear people's stories. And this is why he can't complete anything. But it also means that he's always asking questions. He's quite a bright guy. I mean, he's a PhD student. He teaches. We hear some of the stories he invents. You know, hopefully, like, people find them as engaging as his kids find them. But at the same time, he's someone who I could have imagined that a reader would, if you didn't go along with his kind of wacky openness, then maybe you wouldn't sort of fall into sort of, I guess, this gravity that in the way that I did. So I think that was a concern.
Was there a concern of when you have city people moving into an area, a rural area, and looking at people who we will call as offbeat or, you know, normal, but there's a fine line between exploring that and making fun of it.
Absolutely. I mean, it's hard to write anything in America without being afraid that you're going to offend somebody.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not even going to go through the list of people I was afraid I was going to offend and I'm not a guy who writes like, you know, shocking stuff, but, you know, I was afraid in Winter Soldier I'd like offend, you know, the children of, you know, Austrian doctors, because that's what the book's about. You know, like there's people feel like they own stories and,
right.
And I've heard, you know, from, you know, I offended a lot of piano tuners who told me, so I think in writing anything about, you know, contemporary America, that was certainly a fear. I mean, before getting to sort of the city-rural divide, just writing anything contemporary was a concern. At the end of the day, I felt like ultimately the joke in the books is on them. It's on the city people,
right,
you know, who sort of sit on this city mouse, country mouse side of the side of that border. They meet plenty of people. I love them all. I can only hope that, like, in the pages they come across as sort of full people as well.
They certainly do. Daniel Mason is our guest in this week's book show. The name of the new novel is Country People. It is published by Random House. Tell me about the children, because they're such an integral part of the book and so beautifully rendered.
Thank you. So there's Kate, the wife who's got this job, Miles, the husband, and then they have two kids. They have a 12-year-old named Wesley and a 9-year-old named Olive, both of whom are pretty precocious in the way that, like, any child in Silicon Valley is considered precocious. But Wesley's like a very bookish kid who spends a lot of time engaged in role-playing games, inventing these worlds. And Olive is a bit more of an artist. She chronicles their trip across the country with her box of Crayola 64, sort of describing the different colors as they pass through the country. They love their father's stories. That's an important part of the book, that Miles, far more than working on his dissertation, loves telling them stories at night. And I think they're active participants in the creation of those works.
He realizes, it seems to me, that is a power he has. Mm-hmm. That's something that he's good at, for a guy that may not feel that he's good at much.
Right, I think so. And part of his, you know, I'm not gonna put tragedy in caps here, but, like, you know, part of his life's difficulty is the fact that, like, he's a wonderful storyteller for children. And he made the mistake at one point at a time deciding that since he loves books, he's going to study them, but he doesn't want to write anything. He wants to tell the stories. He has this much more sort of fundamental relationship to the stories. I mean, a much more childish relationship to the story. I mean, childish in all the best ways.
Right. And also because another turn of tragedy in the book is that his wife is ill, and that is something that they have to deal with as well, even though as her career progresses.
Right. She's a brilliant person, but early on in her life, or in high school, towards the end of high school, was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, or maybe at the beginning of college, and has sort of experienced, you know, both like all the challenges that like a person with a chronic illness faces, but at the same time has benefited from a revolution in treatment for multiple sclerosis. But at the moment the book takes place means that she's in remission, but the possibility that the disease could relapse sort of always hangs over her. They, as a couple, sort of wonder if one of the reasons why she's so extraordinarily ambitious is she doesn't know when it might return. Miles has been very dedicated to her, which I think is one reason why she puts up with him much more than many other women probably would have put up with a similar husband.
But he seems to realize that, right? I mean, he questions himself quite a great deal.
He knows that, and I think one of the fun parts about writing this is that because this is the first time I've written anything contemporary, first time I've written like a real, like a domestic novel, like a book about a relationship, is that, you know, you really see how you can learn about people by how they're reflected in other people. And so even just like what you said right now felt very much like what it was like to write the book, to think that like Kate has an illness, Miles takes care of her in illness. Kate knows this about Miles, and Miles knows that Kate knows this about Miles. And so it's like, I mean, that's like any relationship though, right? We're constantly reflecting on each other.
And a relationship not without its just normal challenges beyond all of these other factors.
Right. Certainly it's normal challenges, and as they pick up and move to this town where they have many kinds of sort of fantasies about like this perfect idyllic life, they're, you know, without plot spoiling, there are going to be other challenges, right, because of the people that they meet. I think that's built into the DNA
sure.
of any kind of move somewhere else story.
Well, and any kind of relationship at
any
times.
Kind of relationship,
yes,
right.
after a period of time. And then I want to get to the dog. I love the dog so much. Tell us about this beautiful creature.
Ah, thank you. I can talk a lot about the dog because the dog is the most autobiographical part of the book. And I realize I've been talking about the book. The book just came out last week, so I've been talking about the book a little bit. And I realize I've been doing a disproportionate amount of time talking about the dog. And I had this sort of thought that, like, I wonder if talking about a dog is a bit like talking about dreams, and it's much more interesting to the dog owner and the dreamer. So the dog in the book, his name is Giuseppe. The dog is a breed of dog called a Lagotto Romagnolo. Maybe somebody here has anyone heard of a Lagotto Romagnolo? So a couple
one,
people, that's
two,
wonderful.
Yeah.
So I had never heard of a Lagotto Romagnolo, but during the pandemic, my family, like many other families, decided we wanted a dog, and we needed a hypoallergenic dog. And basically all hypoallergenic dogs were taken, except for Lagotto Romagnolos. And this should have been a warning, maybe. Because this is a truffle hunting dog, and you know, if you're not in the mountains of Oregon or Italy, your dog's gonna go looking for something else. It's like an animal that's highly attuned to the world of smell. So we have one of these dogs, and the dog accompanied us. In the book, the dog's name is Giuseppe. You know, they name him after his Italian roots. And he plays a big part in the book because he perceives the world differently from everyone else, as everybody here who has a dog knows. And I just, you asked me about the dog in the book, and I'm telling you about my dog, but...
But you said it was all autobiographical.
I guess that's right. So it's a good excuse for me to talk about my dog. What I found both in writing Northwoods and in writing this book is that I spend more time with him than any other live being by far. Like, he's with me all the time. He's on my lap a lot of the time. He'll tell me when it's time to take a break by kind of coming up and telling me. I don't think he's interested in my break. I think he's interested in his break, but they usually coincide with each other. But the most wonderful part is just seeing him perceive a world which I can't perceive. And I think because he's so attuned to the to the olfactory world, that there'd just be these moments where I'll be sitting there and I'll be looking out and the day seems dull. And he's sitting there and his nose is sort of going like a muffler, you know, just kind of shaking like that. And it's clear that something really exciting is happening outside. And it's always like a little bit of a kick. He kind of tells me, even though I don't know what it is, that there's something else that I could look for.
He seems like a creature that also brings the characters together, that it's a commonality.
Right. They all love him, and they all love him in their own way, or they're frustrated by him in their own ways. And that was fun to play with. You know, there are moments where the dog does things that are so classic for a dog to do in the novel that I felt necessary to sort of break the wall between me and reader and acknowledge that, like, a dog disappearing into a cave, for instance, is something that happens to a dog in a novel. And I'm not going to avoid it just because other people have had dogs disappear into caves in other novels. This book will also have a dog disappear into the cave. But he's central to the plot.
There are, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but there are moments in the novel that are vignettes, really. And so did that change the writing in any way, in the sense that there were stories and then they're compiled, or was it still written in a linear fashion?
It was written pretty linearly, and I thought at the beginning that it was going to be sort of like purely a contemporary novel about a family, like a very lighthearted novel. And you know, this was also at a time when every time I opened up my computer, if I happened to have a news page open, you know, I usually left feeling pretty down and worried about the world. And so it was a kind of escape, like these little vignettes were just like a moment to try to find some sort of lightness in my experience, or maybe like a little bit more of our experience at large. And so at the beginning they were just those, and it wasn't until about a third of the way through the book, they're on a nature hike with this very bombastic man who's feeding them all sorts of wrong information, that they come across this legend that this man sort of tells them, belabors them with, about there being a portal to an underworld, like literally that the earth is hollow, he believes, and that somewhere in the mountains of southern Vermont you can find a passage in to this underground kingdom there. And then at that point I felt like, well, this could be fun, and the book can be something, you know, can kind of tap the supernatural or a fantastic world in a slightly different way.
Was there any hesitation on your part of going, oh, maybe I'm going too far here?
I mean, all the time.
Yeah.
Like all the time.
But once you go into a supernatural sense, that's a step.
Yeah. I mean, so there are many moments, I mean, especially again, kind of getting back to humor.
Right.
Where I think that, I mean, I have such respect after this, writing this to someone who does stand-up comedy. I mean, because it's this art of pushing it as far as you possibly can, and then not an inch further. And so that was this constant dynamic with, like, they're on the hike, and he's saying things that are increasingly ridiculous. He thinks that he led Beyonce on a hike. He's telling him about how he took care of Beyonce's blister, how he carried out some K-pop star on his shoulder. He's telling him there's no snakes in Vermont. Miles' son is correcting him and telling him there actually are snakes in Vermont. He's pointing out really common plants and getting them wrong. And so, like, in a scene like that, the typical thing would be for me is, I'd have like twice as much, and I might still sort of find it engaging, but it was this question of like, how far is it too much? That was that's the constant dynamic in writing this book. How much is too much, and I knew I need to pull it back.
Daniel Mason is our guest. We are talking about the new book, Country People. It is now out from Random House. When you say you would almost have too much material then, and you would pull it back, but then you also get to the purest sense of what you want,
right?
The best gems, if you will.
Right. Like for me, I mean, I think like many, many writers, it's always a constant process of like pushing too far and then refining, you know, pushing too far and refining, kind of making space for something, making space for a character, see what they do in that space, and then, you know, realizing that a reader has to tolerate them, and so sort of crafting them back.
Did you know where you were headed at all times?
Probably more so than with Northwoods, which I really didn't know up until like the very last chapter of the book, how it was going to end. This one, I think I had a pretty good sense, how can I say this without giving away the ending? I mean, one thing is, I wanted to write a happy book, and not just as, you know, at first it began as like a form of maybe self-therapy, but then it almost afterwards became like more of an aesthetic challenge. Like, I'd written a book about a war on the Eastern Front, like I've written a book about climate change, like lots of bad things have happened in other books that I've written, and I thought, you know, in some ways, you know, there are challenges in doing that, but it's almost harder sometimes to write something which is light, or I found it harder. If I write about medicine, for instance, it's a lot easier to write about a doctor who does something wrong than to write about a doctor who's just like purely good.
Sure.
And so I think that was something about this book. I thought, I want part of the aesthetic of the book, the colors that the book are to be painted with, that it's gonna, you know, make me feel uplifted by the end of my time writing it. And so like that was a direction that I knew that I was headed. And I think that, again, without giving out too much of the book, it meant that certain things were going to happen.
Did that help, the fact that it was contemporary, did that help in that regard, in the sense that you're keeping it lighter, but we're in a time that we're all in, and it's not so much research, it's not as much, I mean, obviously, the work is the work, but there are those commonalities that are on the face.
So writing a contemporary book was easier in some ways because I didn't have to do research, and my ability to do research now, age 50, is a lot different from my ability to do research when I started out writing 25 years ago. I used to be able to go in and read and remember what I read.
So, weren't those the days?
I know. Winter Soldier, I could remember where I wrote it down. Now I can't even do that. So there's something like a big relief of writing something contemporary. But the challenge with something contemporary is that history is like moving as you're writing it. And that was like my big fear, is that something would happen in our world that would disrupt this story in this fundamental way. And it did happen a little bit. I think earlier versions of the book had more barbs at academia. And there's still quite a few, but I also sort of like by the time I was, you know, well into the book, academia had sort of taken such a beating already that the jokes didn't feel that funny. Like, you know, to laugh at someone who's down is not quite so funny.
Oh, that's interesting. So it was not that one thing took over. It was a conscious decision to say, okay, this has been battered enough.
Yeah, or I think, you know, maybe it was, I think there was some of that, or it was a little bit more, less thought of, just like it wasn't as funny anymore.
Right. Right. Well, that's
like,
right.
All of a sudden, this is pretty serious. Someone making fun of. I mean, the book has to do. A lot of the book has to do with why we believe things that are untrue, and just how different people approach fact differently.
What would give you an idea like that?
Yeah. and so that was, that's on my mind. That, you know, I like, but for some reason that with the jokes about that, maybe that because that's a bit. That's a timeless problem about people
believing
things not true, is something that, you know, has a little bit of a deeper reach than say some of the struggles of contemporary academia.
When I asked you about if you knew where it was going to end, and you gave a beautiful answer about wanting it to be like we always, at least I did. You feel very comforted by these characters as well.
Yeah, and I think that I felt like I wanted to do that. Like there was this interesting moment where I thought, like, I haven't done that before. What would it be like to do that? Like what would it be like to be silly? Like what? And I think the fun part for me is that the most enjoyable part of this on a day-to-day basis is the sentence and trying to write a sentence which is different and use words that are different or sounds that are different and rhythms that are different. And so being silly, like, actually is like giving me a whole other register with which to write in. And so I think I hadn't thought about this, that actually, like, that there were these sort of challenges, that there were these rhythms of silliness, which were actually, like, fun and new and had their own difficulties that made it, you know, like, the topic is light, but for me, it still was, like, a challenge to write. I don't know if that makes sense.
It does. Typically, when I read a novel and I know that I'm going to interview the author, and It's after that when I start reading reviews and so forth. I was struck by one term in the New York Times review where they referred to it as a babbling brook of a novel. I didn't know how I felt about that, so how do you feel about that?
I like that. I mean, who wouldn't want to be called
babbling brook? It's beautiful. It's a beautiful idea.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm going to go, like, riff on that a little bit, like what I like is, I mean, I like the sense of, like, all these different sounds that you would get with a brook.
Yep.
I think the book has these different sounds. I don't think, you know, like, someone like Miles kind of moves like that. I mean, he's like someone who floats along, and so that seems to capture him well.
And it's not clearly defined exactly where it's going.
Not where it's going, and you know, hopefully it doesn't dry up. But
right.
It's babbling for now. Yeah. He babbles. I mean, again, like, I don't want to go off on this too much, but I like it now. Like, a baby babbles. Like, there's a sort of, like, fundamental form of communication that we engage in, how lovely it is that a brook also does that.
I would think a character like that, Miles, would stay with you. Maybe more so than other characters.
No, he definitely has stayed with me. So I had this strange experience of, like, when the book was published and seeing his name for the first time in print, like, feeling like, oh, they know him. Like he's, you know, and then knowing, of course, like, silly, the review's gonna have his name in it, but I know him better than many, many, many people in my life.
But you like the idea of sharing him.
Yeah, I like being with him. So if other people want to hang out too, that's great. You know, it's like if you like someone, if you love, like, a kid or a dog, like, you want to share him, you want other people to know him, and, you know, in particular, because he's a guy who demands so little, and he's had a tough time, but, like, I feel like at the end of the day, like, he has this essential goodness. Sure, of course I'd want to share him.
I won't put you on the spot and ask you what is next, but do you have that sort of lined up as to where you're headed?
Not really. I mean, I have ideas that ideas that have sort of been batting around for a bit. But I've, you know, one thing I've learned is that this is a pretty hard period to write, like, when I'm talking about this book and these characters.
Yeah.
And so it's nice. I get to read, I get to not write for a little while, and I have an excuse to not do that.
Again, Daniel Mason is the author of the new novel, Country People, published by Random House. Thanks to our producer, Madeline Reynolds, and our on-site engineer, Matt Seriani. Thanks to the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, Massachusetts, odysseybks.com. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.